Morning, may it please the court.
You may proceed.
I'm Melinda Gorman. I represent the relator in this case, Mario Richardson. And we're here today based on a claim that Mr. Richardson has made that Rule 32.07 allows for an automatic change of judge within a 10-day window after the filing of a superseding indictment adding charges against the defendant. The respondent has taken the position that an initial plea is a one-time event and that an arraignment on new charges is only for the purpose of informing a criminal defendant that he has additional charges. However, the relator takes the position, as well as I do, that any new and additional charges have to have initial pleas entered. So at the time that those new initial pleas need to be entered, the door for 32.07 reopens and a change of judge is appropriate. If the court would look to the its own Rule 23.10 and to Statute 545.110, they address indictments and what happens when a superseding indictment is filed. When a superseding indictment is filed, by operation of law, the previous filed indictment relating to the same matter is quashed. And so essentially, the charges pending become a new case because there are additional charges.
But you're not saying if just the same charges had been refiled that they would get a new time period. You're saying it was because new charges were added. Am I correct?
That is correct. The law makes distinctions between whether superseding indictments add charges or they do something just to, say, prove someone as a prior and persistent offender. Mm-hmm. In that situation, then the door would not be reopened. I am saying because...
So could the judge have just, under your argument then, so the judge could have sustained the change of judge to the new charges and kept the old charges?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that that's possible because the charges were all under the same cause number.
Well, but you're telling me the cause number doesn't matter. It's the count number that matters.
Well, I'm saying
because
that
there certainly isn't an initial plea to the other charges.
Correct. But what I'm saying is that once that superseding indictment is filed, the previous indictment is quashed by operation.
So then your response to Judge Stith is yes, even correct. If it's the same charges, I get it.
With the additional, yes.
No. Even the same. Let's say they substitute it. Let's say they substitute it with one extra, and you get up there and you file a change of judge, and the prosecutor says, look, Judge, I'm not going to let them use that for continuance. I'll just dismiss the added one. They've already entered an initial plea to the new one. Then what's the answer to your question?
Judge, can I have you repeat that for me?
Sure.
I lost you at one point.
It seems to me the difference is it the case number that counts or is it each count that counts? And your argument is it's each count. But under your argument, you said since it's all new, it's a new case. But I'm saying, well, if it's the same, let's say the same for sake of this question, that it's the same charges with a new indictment. Maybe they just chose a lesser included offense.
That, again, is distinguishable because if it was just a lesser included offense, there would be no need to rearrange.
But I think the point was that you may have spoken a little too broadly when you said the first one disappears and the second one's treated like an entirely new charge, because that's clearly not the case if they're just repeating the prior counts. So you sort of overspoke about the effect of filing a new one. But to address the other part of the Chief Justice's argument, your argument really does go to the new count. So assuming you were correct that you were entitled to plead to that, which they did, and you're entitled to request a change of judge for them, would it then be up to the prosecutor to decide whether to keep them together so they all go to the new judge or whether to sever them or dismiss and refile them as separate cases?
Well, and I think that the prosecuting attorney had the opportunity to make that choice at that time. There was never any movement to sever the charges. That would be a whole different argument.
But you're just saying the court doesn't get the option to send some and not others to somebody else. It's the prosecutor who decides to bring them together separately.
Yes. And in this instance...
So just so I understand your argument, and I'm actually making no arguments. I've got all questions for
you.
Thank you. I can't tell if it's. It sounds like to me you're saying every count matters for purposes of a change of judge, and cases don't matter at all because If you added two counts to a case, and you filed a change of judge, why couldn't the judge just sustain your change as to the new counts?
I believe in that instance, then the counts would have to be severed and filed.
That's fine. I sustain your request as to four and five. We'll proceed to trial on counts 1, 2, 3. You think he has the authority to do that?
I do not. And I think because of section 545.110 and rule 23.10, that upon the filing of the superseding indictment, the previous one is quashed entirely.
But I thought you just agreed with me that if they were all the same charges again or a lesser included one, that wouldn't matter and you wouldn't have to do a plea.
Well, I think that would not matter for a reason. I think maybe you're not understanding the reason I think that there's a distinction. It's because of the new charges, the new initial pleas need to be entered. In the scenario that you're describing, there would be no need to rearrange a defendant on charges that he had previously entered.
But your argument is that the old indictment or oral information is quashed. And so if it's quashed and it's gone, then this is a new indictment, new. Your argument is then that even if they're exactly the same, that they'd have, that's the initial plea on those charges in that new indictment.
And case law makes distinctions as to when that's required and when it's not.
And is that because of the distinction between amending and re-indicting?
Correct. In this instance, the state went back to grand jury and actually sought a new indictment as opposed to amending an existing information or an existing indictment.
And we may just be talking semantics here, but that's the point. So saying the first one disappears and it's like an entirely new one really does argue too much, because then you'd get a replead to everything and you're not even claiming we do that. They amended the initial ones and they added new ones to which he'd not made a plea before and has a right to make an initial plea. And you're saying therefore he has a right to a change of judge. And our questions really go to, that would only apply to the new counts, wouldn't it?
I believe it applies to all counts.
And why? Because he's already pled to the other counts. Well, and he doesn't have to do a new plea as to them, you just agreed. So,
just the state's setting the arraignment. The arraignment was set for all of the new counts under the superseding indictment, not just the two additional counts.
So in the plea agreement, the arraignment memorandum that was signed by counsel on behalf of the defendant, it says the defendant through counsel enters a plea of not guilty to the offenses charged. I mean, there was no listing of which charges they were. So are you saying it was all the original charges and the new charges?
Yes.
If I believe you are saying that the language in the rule initial plea is ambiguous and it could reasonably be interpreted to be the first time a defendant is required to plead versus is it initial plea to every charge in the case. Is that a fair statement of your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if in fact it is ambiguous and we're looking at the purpose of the rule, why should we find that it is the correct interpretation to define initial plea as when a defendant pleads to every charge?
Well, Your Honor, I think when a situation is unclear, the rule of lenity will default to the defendant, not to mention that 32.07 is broadly construed as written. All of the case law.
There are some pretty strict time frames.
There are.
To file for a change of judge. And so those strict time frames would indicate that the court in adopting that rule wanted to limit and did not want to permit a change of judge as the case progresses. So that would weigh in favor of it just being the initial plea, the first time a plea was ever entered. What weighs in favor of it being when a plea is entered to any charge?
Well, and Judge, what weighs in favor to, what I'm getting from you is that the time limit is there to deter people from trying to take a change of judge too far into the proceedings. However, case law on point will make the argument against that position, because in State v. Davis and in re matter of Echocamp v. Mason, both of those were cases that were heard, appealed, remanded back to circuit court, and where changes of judges were still allowed due to the new designation of the trial judge when they came back. So I don't think it's the legislature's intent. I don't think it's the court's intent interpreting its own rule to limit things solely because a judge has made prior substantive rulings on the issue.
Let's talk about the designation language, which seems relevant here, although maybe not to your argument, to the greater question. It says if the designation of the trial judge occurs more than 10 days after the initial plea, the application should be filed within 10 days of the designation of the trial judge. That doesn't envision some infinite series of trial judges, an infinite series of designations. It seems to anticipate there will be one of them, or at least for purposes of the change of judge rule, there is only one of them.
Yes, and Judge, my argument to that effect is that when Relator was rearranged in April of 2018, at the bottom of that form that St. Louis County has always used to comply with the rules dealing with arraignment, the case was then at that point designated back to Division I.
But how did it ever get to the presiding judge to begin with? There's nothing in the record that indicates that it was the designation to Judge May was ever taken away.
At the bottom of the form where arraignment waivers happen, you will see at the very bottom that that is where it says that it is assigned.
But did he have any power to do that? Wasn't the case with Judge May all the time, and he had no power to designate it to anywhere else?
Well, I think that power came back into play once it was rearranged and had to be assigned after arraignment.
Why? What is the basis of saying that?
How did it ever leave May for purposes of the subsequent arraignment? Who designated the other division to take that plea and redesignate May?
Presiding Judge Douglas Beach. And again, that's just the way.
How do we know that?
Yeah, where in the record does it show this case is transferred from that division to this?
For the presiding judge to conduct an arraignment.
It's on the arraignment form. It's just the only place that it says that.
No, it shows it assigned it to him, but how did it get to him to be assigned? Why wasn't it always with Judge May? They're saying, how did it ever leave to go to the presiding judge for reassignment?
I believe that's just the function of the form and the culture of
St. Louis
County.
Or is it just the culture? I mean, lots of places do things differently than St. Louis, you might be surprised.
Absolutely.
just because they do, does that make it wrong? And just because you put something at the bottom of your form, does that make it so?
I believe it makes it the custom and the way that those courts operate. I'm not saying that makes it right or correct. I'm just saying that's the way.
I guess a better way to ask it is, did Judge Beach have any other choice other than to send it back to Judge May? Could he send it to anyone he wanted to?
Well, I suppose by operation of the local rule that my opposing counsel pointed out in his brief, 6.3 notes that civil and criminal cases shall be assigned to the judges sitting in jury trial divisions, and 36.1, I believe, 6.3 says that they shall be assigned by the circuit court in a random and equal basis. So I suppose he did have the authority after arraignment, should he have chosen to exercise it, to assign it somewhere else.
Okay, but back to the culture, that doesn't happen.
No, it does not happen. And the relator had another case pending in that division. And typically, for purposes of judicial efficiency, if there are pending cases.
But the local rule says the circuit court shall do it, not the presiding judge.
Well, that's, again, the custom that it's always been the presiding judge who makes those designations.
And I think there's a statute that says that another judge just can't come in and hear another judge's case, right? I mean, they have to be designated in order to hear and take some action in the case.
Yes.
Did the case number ever change?
No. And it remained with a dash 01. There was never even a dash 02. So it did not change in one bit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
You may proceed.
Ryan Kemper on behalf of Respondent Judge May. Your Honors, this matter concerns the application of the change of judge rule found at 32.07 to circumstances where the state files a superseding indictment after all of the time limits of the rule have passed for change of judge. The court has said it will generally apply the plain language of its own rules, just as it does to statutes, and in the absence of ambiguity, will apply the language of the rule as written. Two timing provisions are at issue here under 32.07B. Either party can take a change of judge as a matter of right within the later of 10 days after the initial plea, and obviously that language is important, or within 10 days of the designation of the trial judge if that is later. Facts in this case are relatively succinct for purpose here. In July of 2016, the defendant, Mr. Richardson, was arraigned on three charges. He entered his initial plea of not guilty in cause number 16SL CR04006. At the time he entered his initial plea, no change was requested. At that time, now retired Judge Goldman was appointed as the trial judge. So this had been in July of 2016. He retired shortly thereafter, and by administrative order in November of 2016, so about 4 months later, Judge May was assigned to preside over this case.
That was a designation, is that?
And that was an appointment by any reasonable reading of the term designation, yes. He was designated in November of 2016.
And you would concede that within 10 days of that act, they could have moved for a change?
I would. Because Judge May had been designated for the first time by that administrative order from Judge Goldman to Judge May, that was their first opportunity to see Judge May was presiding over this cause number.
Well, and to simplify, let's say that the superseding indictment, that the plea to the superseding indictment had been taken by May. We'll leave Beach out of it, all right? What about that makes it a new initial, or does not qualify as a new initial plea for purposes of the change rule?
Sure. I think the plain language of the word initial plea, I mean, I think the initial plea is intended to follow the cause number and the case as a whole, not what happens with the case down the road.
So if the initial cause, say it had been a tampering C or writing a bad check or anything, and then you could amend it and add murder, kidnapping, any number, burglary, you know, 20 different things that you decided, oh, this is that guy. We got a lot of charges we want to file against him. You might get a plea to those, although you seem to think it's just to inform them of the charges. It sounds like one. But second, you're saying that initial plea in your decision not to change from Judge May for the tampering case means you can't change for murder, kidnapping. Maybe you're seeking the death penalty and you know he has a reputation of liking the death penalty. There's all sorts of reasons, in other words, that the type of charge being brought may affect whether you want to change the
judge. I would agree to some extent, Your Honor. The type of charge could potentially affect your assessment of Judge May as allowed under this rule. But if we are charging something so distinct and outside of sort of the known facts at the time of the initial plea, then severance is going to be an issue.
Well, it might be, but that won't really make any difference because you'll have Judge May in both because you just said that your initial plea covers anything that's filed there. So it's a great way to, if you like the judge and you get a good judge for that first one, you keep everything with them.
I think the severance issue.
What you're saying is that there's some logical, has to be some logical connection to the same facts, and if it grows out of the same facts. But there's nothing in our, and that would be a logical thing to do, but it's not in the rule. It's a good way to write the rule, perhaps. But it doesn't say that now, so there's really no limit.
I do think, Judge, that the limit of the severance rule would be helpful in that regard, in that if we really think that there needs to be this reassessment of the judge decision, that at this time of arraignment, at this time of, you know, within your time to take this initial plea, if there's a motion to sever and these additional counts are pulled apart, then with regard to the new cause, with regard to the new cause number that's created, you would then be within the time period.
And who has, does the judge have authority to sever on their own, or do they have to have a motion by the prosecutor, or is that not clear at this point?
I believe it's not clear from what we have here, but I believe one party would have to move for severance.
But you see my point that, I mean, it is the initial plea as to these new charges. You may feel here they should have known about this and there's no harm, no foul, but we have to set a rule that applies to any case.
I absolutely understand.
And they have not pled
to these drug charges before. It's the first time they're brought up. They had a right to plead. You couldn't not let them plead guilty or not guilty. Why doesn't it run from that point? Because it's the designation of the judge after that initial plea, not some other initial plea to some other charge.
I would say, Judge, is the way the rule is constructed with regard to this initial plea, with regard to this very short 10-day time period, it's intended to encompass this sort of body that we know is the case going forward. Now, if we get down the road, I completely understand your point, Judge. If we get down the road and there becomes this sort of distinct thing that comes in that no one had notice of, that had nothing to do with
and
the
again,
original.
And again, I understand why that's a logical way to write the rule, but I don't understand why that's how it's actually written now.
Judge, I will be honest with you. The way the rule is actually written here, I think is very clear with regard to you have a right to an initial plea in a case. You, of course, have a right to make a plea in subsequent charges that come, but it's not an initial plea in this cause number. It just wouldn't be the initial plea because it's not at the inception of this cause.
So, but a lot of circuits, when there's a superseding indictment, there's a new case number. So are you saying in those circuits, then, where there are new case numbers created, then the initial plea would entitle the person to a change of judge?
I think with regard to the way things are handled in St. Louis County, we talked a little about local practices. I mean, I think really the body of the case is what matters for purposes of deciding if there has been an
initial plea. So it's the facts and not the case number and not the charges?
Well, I think with regard to if you have a separate practice of giving it a new case number, that would certainly cut in favor of that, but I don't know that that would be determinative because you have theoretically entered an initial plea to much of what exists in that new case, and whether or not something needs to be severed, I think, is a separate question. I think the issue here, judges, is your honors, is whether or not we're going to basically read in additional language. If we're going to basically say what the rule really means is within 10 days of the initial plea or subsequent pleas to additional related charges, because in order to take the change under these circumstances, we'd have to basically read in that language. And I think the phrase initial plea sort of stands on its own.
So when you have a new charge and you plead to the new charge, why isn't that the initial plea to the new charge?
I think it would be the
plea. It's the first time you pled to this charge.
It is the first time we've addressed that charge, but there has been an initial plea in the case.
And where does it say you go by the case number, which again then begs the question if it's not a new case
well,
number.
It certainly does not.
Right. So the clear battleground is, does initial plea mean case or count, right?
I think that's
so
correct, Judge.
Reasonable judges might differ as to whether it meant case or count. What's the policy reason? What's the policy reasons for saying it ought to be case instead of count? And I'm going to ask your opposing counsel, what's the good policy for saying count as opposed to case? So give me your best shot.
Thank you, Judge. So this didn't get added to the brief. I mean, in this case, respondent has largely relied on the plain language of the statute, but I understand that multiple judges have brought up this ambiguity issue. This rule was actually amended in 1993. So prior to the 1993 amendments, 32.07 allowed a change of judge to be taken in the same two type of time periods. The first was 30 days after arraignment. The rule used to say arraignment, 30 days after arraignment, or 30 days after the trial judge is designated. So under this prior version of the rule, for every arraignment, theoretically, for every added count, you theoretically would have been entitled to a change within 30 days. But the rule has been changed to this initial plea language, which, quite frankly, sort of shows the distinction that we're looking for here, that the court, at least as I would read this, didn't want these subsequent possibilities of change because there's only one initial plea. So that's number one.
Because you would argue that if the court just wanted to change it from 30 days to 10 days, it would have left the language the same.
It could have left the language the same. It could have also kept a 30-day period so that there was a little longer time to consider this. But I think, Your Honor, this really speaks to sort of the policy of this. I mean, this is not intended to give the parties an opportunity to consider the judge's rulings and then decide to make a change. I mean, this is really intended to allow both sides early on in the case, within 10 days, to sort of assess the judge in the abstract. Is this someone I want presiding over a criminal case for me?
But again, that begs the question, what case? Because you agree you can't put the kitchen sink in, so why can you put in other things arising out of the same facts?
It seems to me that if the state were to try to do that, try to sort of Trojan horse in some additional charges, those are going to be severed. I mean, and we keep coming back to that, but my concern with the...
But you've lost your right to seek a change of judge for them.
I think if it were to be severed, there would still be.
It would still be before the same judge. You wouldn't, and you would have already had them all the way along. You'd be out of luck.
I think if the separate charges were severed, if counts 4 and 5 had been severed here, I think they still would have had a right in that separate new case now.
And where in the rule does it do that?
I think
like in our earlier case, you can argue the other side.
I will be honest with you, Judge. I mean, the case law on interpreting this provision is pretty sparse. So coming back to
But your argument would be when it's severed, there's a brand new case created, there's a new designation of a trial judge and a new time period for a change.
Should it be severed, I believe that would be the case. I don't believe that there's any case law on that point, but, I mean, logically that makes sense, I believe.
That's who controls the case once the case is filed, whether there's severance or not. But the control actually is in the hands of the prosecutor when they decide whether to amend or to quash. Mm-hmm. And once it's quashed, once the old is quashed, the subsequent indictment is a brand new case, irrespective of whether a new number is given to it or not. Is that correct?
So is it a brand new case? I believe that in this circumstance, the counts were added by way of superseding indictment. And so the body of it as it existed as counts 1 through 3, an initial plea had been entered, and they were entitled to a subsequent plea of counts 4 and 5.
No, but a subsequent indictment quashes the previous indictment, correct?
And that by rule that happens, but there are circumstances where a previous indictment can be revived for various reasons.
It wasn't in this case.
And it was not in this case.
Right.
It was not in this case.
So going back to the arraignment on April the 12th, the memorandum that was signed by defendant and counsel, two questions. First off, I asked your opponent the statement in the arraignment that says the defendant through counsel enters a plea of not guilty to the offenses charged. Is that to all the offenses, the previous ones and the new ones?
I don't believe the form is abundantly clear on what they're entering a plea to at that time. My understanding has been that they're entering a plea to any charges they wish to enter a plea to, which might include counts 4 and 5.
Might include the old ones?
It might be that they're entering a plea to the only charges on which they're being arraigned that day.
It may be.
Unclear. Okay, then a little further down on the same form, cause is assigned to Division 1 for hearing a determination so ordered by Presiding Judge Douglas Beach. So at that point, wasn't that when the case was, when the new judge was assigned?
It was not,
April
Your Honor.
The 12th?
And the reason for that is because, as you talked about briefly with opposing counsel, local practice dictates that the case is never removed from Judge May. I mean, under local rules and local practices, after the initial plea, after the arraignment, it is assigned to one of our circuit court judges who will have it throughout the pendency of the case. It doesn't matter if the state amends charges, dismisses charges, adds charges, it stays with Judge May.
What if the prosecutor had gotten rid of the initial charges and just filed the new ones, but left the same case number?
The prosecutor got rid of the...
If
it were filed together, if it were filed under the same cause number with new charges but not the old charges?
Yeah, because you did some investigation, decided we're just going to bring these new ones.
I suppose there could be a situation where that would happen if there was some discovery that was conducted and we realized our charge was incorrect,
right.
In which case it would stay with Judge May.
What about you said the case stays with the judge, but what if the state dismisses and refiles? What happens then?
In that case, I believe it would actually, the refiling would return to the presiding judge for actual designation to a certain.
You have a minute and 30 seconds left. Can you tell us the policy reasons to find that initial plea means in the case?
So, I mean, the purpose of this rule, as I said, seems to be this first look at the judge. And what are we, if we think about what's happening in a criminal case between the time of an initial plea and say months down the road when the state might file a superseding indictment, the things that are happening are things like discovery. So the state is getting lab reports, there may be depositions taken, and the state is going to, in the course of many cases, not all cases, but in many cases, there will be adjustments to that charging document before trial. It's the state's obligation to follow through with that. So there is nothing about that process that requires a reexamination of, is this judge suitable to sit in a criminal case? The other thing that happens.
All our judges are suitable for criminal cases. The question is whether it's that particular case.
In the defense
on those particular
state's
charges.
Opinion, is this judge suitable for my case, right? The other thing that happens in that period is the court makes substantive rulings. So part of the reason there's this 10-day limit, in my belief, is because very early on in a criminal case, there's going to be motions on bond. There could be motions on court orders for discovery. There could be issues regarding motions to suppress.
But of course, the state can always dismiss and refile and get a new judge. You're not saying the intent is to give the state a benefit the defendant doesn't have, are you?
I certainly am not. What I'm saying is
But your opposing counsel says that that's a practice in St. Louis County.
To dismiss a case or refile?
After a loss of the suppression hearing and the like.
I would disagree with that characterization. The other thing I would say is if the state chooses to engage in that kind of practice, there are certainly consequences.
My point
in terms of speedy trial rights running, I mean, that's always weighed against the state.
Well, you start again from, one could argue, from the new filing, or in some instances. But the point being, if the reason is so they can't get a free look at the rulings and then get a new judge, but the state clearly can and appropriately can dismiss and refile, would that be a valid reason?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And if the court will allow me one sort of wrap-up comment on that point.
I'll let you wrap up if you'll answer one question for me first. If we're to take the defendant's view in this case, you won't have to dismiss and refile. You'll just have to add one more count and then file your change as soon as that's over. Why would you dismiss it and start over?
And that,
especially if they're in custody or out on bond or anything else.
Judge actually goes to my very last point, which I think is Respondent Judge May's biggest concern, is that if both parties theoretically have the right to take this change after the filing of a superseding indictment, it actually gives the state more power to go back and slowly add counts and theoretically judge shop. I mean, this would be a power that would not just go to the defendant to take a change, but the state to take a change.
But the state can already do that.
And Judge, I don't know.
Well, not without dismissing the case,
right.
You can't do it.
Well, and that's correct. Not without dismissing the case and not without what I believe are significant consequences in terms of just relationships with working with the parties and with the court.
So now you argue that your position is for judicial efficiency, but so how often does filing supersedious informations exist?
You know, I asked to see how often we think that happens in our office, and I would say not in the majority of cases, probably in a percentage that I would think is less than 20% of the cases, but I'm really just estimating based on my personal experience. And usually it relates to things like we issue on an assault charge on a 24-hour hold because we need to get this guy off the street, and then we get drug labs back 6 months later, and then we add a drug charge with superseding indictment. It is generally not, and I certainly understand the concern, it is generally not a complete reformulation of mm-hmm. the case and the charges, because if we're going to do that, we're usually better off dismissing.
But here we had a 2-year delay, and then it was done. Is that right?
That is correct. And the 2-year delay was actually based upon when this was set for trial. This was the adding of this drug charge was sort of a cleanup of things we basically already had for purposes of making sure we were presenting everything at trial. And that included the fact that he was in possession of a controlled substance.
I have a question for my own curiosity. In this case, Judge May asked the parties to informally brief the change of judge issue. Can you explain that to me, what an informally brief something is?
So at the time that this was discussed, it was a pretrial conference where all of the parties were sort of just speaking with the judge about how we were going to schedule things and what was going to happen. At that time, the state informed the parties that we were thinking of going back with a superseding indictment to add these drug charges. There was an informal discussion where counsel indicated that there may be this change taken, so this issue may arise. Judge May basically said, well, I don't have a motion pending before me at this time, so we don't have anything formal to discuss, but if you would like to know, you know, share amongst yourselves and with the court what you think the answer to this sort of esoteric legal question is, please do so.
The informal briefs were written briefs that were physically handed to the judge but not filed in the record.
I believe defendant's brief was hand delivered to the court in written format. I believe the state's memo was simply sent by email.
And how common is this not to put a record things that are given to the judge to influence the decision of the judge?
I think, Your Honor, this was the informal conversation was because there was.
I'm not talking about the conversation. I'm talking about submitting written filings to the judge with the statement that they will not be made of record. That's a serious concern.
I don't know that anyone made the statement they wouldn't be made of record.
Well, they're not of record. And he said make it informal, which I understood from your briefing meant they're not of record.
And Your Honor, I don't know that it's very common. I think it was something that happened in part because sort of the difficulty the court envisioned with scheduling.
Oh, I fully get why you want briefing, but normally those then are part of the record because they're part of what the judge is considering.
My thought, Judge, was that if in fact the motion was filed, and then if the state was going to file a formal opposition, that would have been made part of the record. What was sort of done as, you know, Your Honor, here are our thoughts on this issue, was essentially amongst the parties as part of this conversation about scheduling.
All right. And everybody got a copies of everybody else's work.
That's correct. None of this was ex parte. All of this was shared amongst the parties.
Except none of it's in the record before this court.
I believe it is.
Informal briefs, sir?
I believe they were made part of the record.
Are they? Okay.
Prior to the
once the motion hearing. Was filed. Once the motion for change was filed.
I believe so, yes.
Or added them on appeal or with it? Well, we can.
Sure thing.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So what are the policy reasons as to why we should read initial plea to mean count as opposed to case?
Well, I think that the Honorable Judge Stith addressed that better than I probably could, but I'll try to follow the train of her thought, which is the exact problem in this issue.
It can often be difficult for people.
Yeah, but I struggle with it all the time myself.
We'll get informal briefing from her later. Right. Go ahead.
The exact scenario that she addressed is the problem that we have here, that a client can come in, hire a defense attorney on what he thinks is a felony driving while suspended. That case can get parked in front of, you know, a judge who happens to be, you know, a huge animal rights advocate. And then once it's parked there and the 10-day rule is expired, the state can come in by way of superseding indictment and say, oh, and while he was driving while suspended, you know, he left his windows up and killed this dog and, you know, this, that, and the other, and had these animal abuse charges. And essentially it gives them the opportunity to judge shop. If at any point prior to the pendency of, prior to a trial, counts can be added after this defendant or this rule is stripped away from the defendant. It's never stripped away from the state.
But opposing counsel's point is that you knew that's all in discovery. So you know there's an animal that passed away when, and so you can maybe foresee that this could happen and maybe that would go into your decision.
Yes and no. First off, the disclosures that were given did not include the audio taped interview of my client with law enforcement, nor did they include the lab. So the simple mention that some substance that looks like it may be drugs in a police report, I don't think puts someone on notice automatically that these are in fact drugs. And the state had the labs available to them for 18 months prior to disclosing them when they added these charges. And so what I would like to make as a public policy point is that these charges were basically added in relator's opinion, to coerce a plea deal on both cases. They were added very last minute when we were right up against a trial date to say, oh, and by the way, you know, if we can't make the facts on one case, we're going to enhance your exposure on another case. And again, the state has the power at any point in time to nolly and reissue. They can nolly and reissue after they lose a motion to suppress. The defendant, however, has very limited times where he can take a change of judge. And I think that in this particular situation, where, I mean, there's obviously a motive that the state had in adding counts this late in the game. You don't just say, you know, labs we've been sitting on for 18 months, we're going to clean it up. The state has a motivation. The defense counsel has motivations.
Would defense have a motivation to take a change of judge for strategic reasons other than actually wanting a change of judge? Wouldn't it give him an advantage to take a change of judge right before a trial set?
He's confined, so if anything, it cuts again. I mean, he has no motive to take the change of judge just before trial set to avoid trial. he's never been on bond during the pendency of this case.
And the state could have filed these new charges a year earlier if it wanted to.
And the state could have filed these new charges within the statute of limitations as a separate and whole different cause number and still accomplish the goal that they stated they wanted to, which was to clean up everything that they had. The state specifically filed these charges in front of this judge to enhance this defendant's exposure on an existing case, and that is why defendants sought the change of judge. Not that Rule 32.07 asks for a reason, but I'm sure inquiring minds want to know, and that is the reason. Right.
And of course, the rule applies to defendants who are incarcerated who don't want a continuance, and those that are out on bond who may want a continuance. It's kind of the same. It's one of the policy concerns that goes into whether or not this rule applies to counts as opposed to cases. So I appreciate candor and straight response from both counsel in the case. It was well argued, and we'll submit the case and get you a decision in due time.
Thank you, Your Honor.